There are all kinds of those options that need to be looked at that are a problem. Right now, that bill, the issue is the study, and for small districts like Echo or Helix and some of these districts that are 50, 60 kids, I own, is that there may be enough money in that $1.5 million set-aside that we can apply to keep from for enough money to keep from losing another teacher. Our study indicates it takes 6 teachers to maintain a small high school.
And anybody got a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. I'm a little confused. I think your testimony is that $3 per thousand would raise $500,000.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
What was the results of the election when you
We lost it by 50%.
Yeah, I mean, I would just point out to you that in Beaverton, currently, there's property owners are paying taxes of $6.50 per thousand just for capital improvements for new schools. And the voters have consistently supported that. I don't see where $3 per thousand to raise $500,000 is such a bad deal.
In a $17 million budget, the problem isn't the amount. It's who pays and who doesn't pay. That falls on very few of the residents in the county, that $3. 28% of the taxpayers end up paying the whole thing.
But it's only $3 per thousand on those taxpayers. Is that right?
Well, if you're a wheat rancher, that $3 per thousand is a lot of bucks on very few people. I think you have to understand the taxing structure in each of the areas to understand the problem. And it is a problem.
Anything else? Representative Bates?
You mentioned ESDs helping to fund small schools, and I'm always willing to learn more. I wasn't aware that ESDs were doing that, and you mentioned that there's some districts getting as much as 15,000.
That's what the cost is, yes.
What's the cost? What are they actually getting?
That's what they have to get. Yeah, per student.
I mean, is an ESD funding them above the state level to that?
Yes.
I know there's been some discussion about the variation in the amount of money that ESDs are getting, the different ESDs are getting across the state, and there's discussions about leveling that out. Can you give me specifics about how one ESD is allowed to give $15,000 per student and the next ESD?
No ESD is giving that kind of money. The ESDs I'm thinking of fund up to $3,000 per student in addition to what they generate through the small school formula. And they got that prior when ballot measure 5 passed. It limited all of us to a tax rate, and you could have passed a high tax rate at that time and then got a bigger portion of the $5 limit that's for schools. In other words, local districts, ESDs, community colleges all share in that $5 limit of local property tax. Well, if the ESD is a larger percentage of the $5, it wasn't cost the local taxpayers any more money, but a bigger portion of the $5 goes to the ESD and then can go back to the local districts in terms of support. And some of the ESD figured that out. North Central ESD did a good job of figuring that out, and they're funded very, very well. And they help the districts in their counties.
Representative Bates, the ESDs will be coming to us in Senate Bill 260, and I promise you that ESDs will make urban renewal seem like a child's primer.
Mr. Chairman, if I might make a few more comments before I'm through. One is that in the studies that we show that it takes between six FTE to run a small high school in order to cover all the subjects and with the certifications. We've got small high schools out there trying to operate with 4 and 5 teachers, and they just can't offer the programs. So what we're looking for in this study is what it takes to adequately fund and staff small high schools and then find a way to cause that to happen. The alternative is for the legislature to decide that there will not be high schools in small communities. And from where I sit, I don't think that's a real good option. The things that we've had to do since ballot measure 5 passed, and by the way, Morrow County funded its schools at the levels that it chose prior to ballot measure 5. And like most of rural Oregon, those communities did not vote for ballot measure 5. They saw what was coming, and it's here. They've reduced over 20 staff members in a small school district since 1994 in order to stay within the funding levels. And it's getting tighter and tighter. The formula does not work for small high schools. It does not. That's what needs to be studied. And with that information, I think the legislature can make an informed decision about whether to keep those schools at the price it's going to take to keep them open.
Okay. Representative Beck and then Hess.
This is the most frustrating discussion to have that I've faced in my now almost three sessions. I don't like getting into this fight about our people pay more, therefore, you know, we shouldn't be subsidizing you, and you know, we can all have that little discussion. And there's a lot. It's about all I've heard since I've been a legislator. I'm kind of sick of it, and I don't. Of course, your kids should have access to a good quality education. Of course, people in my Portland declining enrollment school district should get a good education. It's going to cost a certain amount of money, maybe less per kid than your place. And of course, Beaverton people ought to be able to have facilities to adapt to a community that has grown. What is frustrating to me is that we all talk about this, and we all know the answer is it's not just fixing the formula, because we know if the pie stays constant, we all get into this little discussion. That's what Sizemore and McIntyre and frankly some of the some members of this body want. What's frustrating is that no one seems to be going to the leadership, which is rural. Just as long as I've been here, it's basically been rural leadership. You have a Speaker of the House. My first session was from represented your district, I believe.
That's
Representative
right.
Lundquist. You have a Speaker now, represents Union and Wallowa, part of Umatilla counties. You have a majority leader who represents those counties and your neighboring county, your neighboring maybe. You have a Senate Revenue Committee chairman, powerful man. He's chairing this companion committee in the Senate. The people who have the power to solve this problem are in many cases rural members. But it involves putting more money on the table and getting aggressive about coming up with a new tax structure, which is what the chair of this good committee tried to do and got stonewalled by all the interest groups. But until your communities unite with our communities to demand a different tax system or more revenues to pay for schools, it's very hard to sit here as an urban legislator and give you a little more. You need a lot more. Every little bit you take comes from me. And then I'm from urban Portland. He's from suburban Portland. And they're getting screwed, too. So I guess I'm making a speech here more to memorialize the moment. Because I appreciate you coming all the way over here. And I am not an urban legislator who's going to say, oh, you guys tired of subsidizing rural Oregon and your way of life and so forth. I spend a lot of time in Eastern Oregon, and I value what your communities do and the people who have chosen to stay, and I think there ought to be a future in that. But I really, really urge Eastern Oregon school districts, board members, ranchers to come down here and demand to the leadership who have been running this building for the last four sessions to fix the problem, to put more money into the system. I can't do that. I'm laughed out of this building when I have that discussion in these hallways, in this committee. I'm laughed at. Don Quixote. There he goes again. Portland liberal. Wants just tax and spend liberal. You know, it's funny. But if we don't, you folks have the power, you have the influence, to make the case more aggressively than you probably have. Not you people necessarily. I don't know what you said and done to your legislators, but it's hard to support this legislation anymore until we really sit down and solve the funding and increase the pie to where it should be, where it would have been had we not cut taxes the way we have.
Well, I have to agree with you, and I think from my perspective, you know, incremental change is what we're about. That's what this bill's about. That's what the legislative process is about. And I'm afraid that we have a couple things that are going against us. One is that my own belief that term limits is really hampering you folks from people finding a coalition and a group of you who can work through a number of sessions to find the answer. And the voters of this state are not, through the initiative process, going to provide the solution to our tax dilemma in the state. It's this body that truly is going to have to come up with a tax solution to get all the legs under the stool and to fund education properly. And I agree with you that our leaders on the east side of the mountains need to work with the rest of you folks to come up with a tax solution that funds education, that funds the other state programs that are necessary, but that becomes the dilemma from those of us who live where I do, and that is that we have to be able to tell the voters when we come up with a new tax strategy that what that strategy is for. You cannot ask the voters to vote for a new tax if they don't know where that money is going to be spent. So I would urge you to come up with a strategy, but it needs to be designated. If you want to fund education at a higher level than we're talking about this session, then any tax that you might go to the voters with needs to be dedicated to education.
Representative Hass, do you still have a question?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chairman. My wife hails from those parts, and I have a question about the geography. You have you said there were 65 people at Ione High School.
Correct.
150 at Heppner.
Right.
And how far are those two high schools apart?
Those communities by the state highway are 19 miles apart. The reality is that we draw students an hour and a half each direction into those communities. So what happens is if you are at the far end of the bus route coming into Ione, and then you have to go on to Heppner, it doesn't take long to get 2 hours on a bus.
I appreciate that.
Okay, and the same thing if you're on the other side of the district. I mean,
we
have more miles than kids in Morrow County.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. I agree with what Representative Beck said. And I would just offer up that Beaverton just built a new high school. It's already full. It's called Southridge. It has 1,600 students.
I'm aware of that, and I think we don't have all the answers here. I mean, I think what we're asking for with this bill is an incremental step in trying to come up with the solution down the road. We're not trying to convince you that this will solve our problem, that it will solve Beaverton's problem, or anyone else's in total. But I think it is an acknowledgement that equal dollars is not equal education in this state. And that's something that we need to all face. And that's part of what this bill attempts to do, is to start realizing that over here it's going to cost so much to offer a high school education. Over here it's going to cost so much, if you're going to figure it per student.
Okay, we need to finish up here with three more witnesses on this bill before we go to our next. Thank you very much,
both of you, Kevin,
coming over today and being with us. We have Barbara Senega, Tim, I'm going to say LeBruce, and Peter Tarzian. former state representative Peter Tarzian masquerading today as superintendent of Falls City Schools.
I apologize for that.
Welcome, I'll let whichever one of you wants to start.
Well, my name is Barbara Seneca. I'll start because I represent the students from Helix High School, Helix School District. I'm the principal and the superintendent, and we're just like Ione. As I listen to that story, I won't repeat it. But what we have done in Helix is the same thing that has happened in Ione. We did pass the local option. We put it out there, and we asked our people to support us, and they did overwhelmingly with a 72% yes vote. They said, you bet, we'll do anything we can to support our schools. That local option was $45,000. We hired a teacher. That teacher relieved the high school so that we could actually have our students that are 6th, 7th, and 8th graders in classes other than in the high school. The compression factor brought that down to $5,000. So, in fact, we have a $45,000 deficit and a teacher. We have 5.5 teachers at our high school. We have students at the University of Oregon. We have students at Oregon State. We have students at Willamette. We have students going to Purdue. We want our students to be able to do that. We have limited our electives to a place now where we have one shop class. Do communities like Helix deserve to keep their high schools? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you they want to keep their high school. They've had their high school there for a long time, and they support it. They want to do whatever it takes to keep their school because they believe that that's going to keep their community alive. We're wind farmers. I don't know if you know that yet, but we're wind farmers. We farm electricity with the wind. We built 20 turbine generators and put them up on a hillside, and now they're going to build 100 more. Those generators are going to generate electricity, and they're going to bring in families to Helix. The two questions that were asked are there available housing for us to live in, and what's the quality of your school? Now, our schools got one of those strong ratings in your report card, and they'll continue to do that. They did it before the report card ever existed, because that community embraces its school system. We are facing a point now where we've cut everything that we can cut. This bill will help us a little bit with the economics. So $200 will bring us roughly $10,000. But what will be even further generated by this bill is whether or not communities have the right to keep their schools. In Oregon, are we going to allow small high schools to exist? If you want to bus them to other places, I suppose that's an option. But it changes the community when you take away their school. It changes the economic development of that community. The people that are coming from Vestas, from California, aren't interested in having their students bused for an hour or a half or 2 hours into Pendleton or into Athena Weston. They want to know if their children can attend school in the area in which they live. I believe that small rural high schools have a lot of advantages, but that's my belief. What I think needs to be explored is whether or not they are going to continue to exist. If they are, they're going to cost a little more because we grow wheat and canola, and we try to grow our children in clumps of 20. At one time, we had 3 sets of triplets in Helix. I think we were known for the triplets, but they just don't come out in groups of 20. And so we have classes that have 20 kids in a class, and we have classes that have 12. We sure take 20. We have an open enrollment policy, and we do take students from other districts that want to go to small rural high schools. So I guess my point here today is to ask you to support this bill. Let us take a look at whether or not these small rural high schools are a viable option in this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. LaBruce.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tim LaBruce. I'm from Pilot Rock. I'm the superintendent at Pilot Rock. If you don't know, Pilot Rock is south of Pendleton, about 15 miles. If you're going south, it's 15 miles. If you're going north, it's 12. The Department of Transportation hasn't decided really how far we are from Pendleton. But I'm going to be very brief. This is a good bill because it does put some dollars into small schools, and our stories are basically very much the same. I think one point I would like to make, the rural schools that we've talked about at this point have been from Eastern Oregon. But rural schools in general around the state, whether you're on the west side, the schools that have anywhere from 50 to about 150, 200 students in them, and small school is defined at 350. But we have a lot of schools on the west side here that are in the same shape that some of us are on in the east. So it truly is a small school issue, not just an Eastern Oregon issue, and I kind of got the impression maybe it's because all of us were speaking here from Eastern Oregon up to this point. The only other thing I would like to say about Pilot Rock, we were one of those districts where, because of compression and no difference in Measure 5 and ballot Measure 50, that we could generate any dollars, so that hasn't been an option to us. We are looking at a rec district to take care of our athletics, which would free a few dollars and hold things off for a little while. But basically, we've made the cuts over the years. We currently have 10 staff members at our high school for about 157 students. And we feel like we've gone, based on what's expected of us, that that's about as low as we can go at that point. In closing, I graduated from McNary here in Salem. I chose to go to Eastern Oregon to teach and be an elementary principal, now a superintendent. I love it over there. We have a lot to offer our kids. And our schools take great pride in the academic achievement of our kids, the extracurricular activities that our kids are involved with, whether it's athletics. Our baseball team was here in Salem last spring playing for the state title. It was a great experience for our kids, and Pilot Rock brought enough people to fill the stadium out here just about, and we had as many people for the 2A game as the 4As did for their larger championship game. And that's not to speak ill of the 4As. I'm just saying that the people take great pride in what their students are taking part in the small schools. So I'll just stop at that point, and thank you for the opportunity for speaking here.
Thank you. And from the west side, then, if you want to...
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, my name is Peter Tarzian. I'm a superintendent and principal at Falls City High School, which is quite close to Salem, if you don't know where it is, just about 30 minutes due west of here.
Six members on this committee right now have been there.
That's right.
Oh, well, that's...
Last session.
That's great. Oh, I see. That was the showcase.
That was the showcase.
All right. Well, I appreciate then your knowledge of Falls City. I must say the results of your work last session were very much appreciated in Falls City and by the Falls City community. I think that it would be fair to say that Falls City School District would not be in the growing and expanding state that it's in if, in fact, the legislation that was passed in 1999 was not passed. It has been a good boost for the community, and it certainly has been a good boost for the high school and the elementary school there. So the community says thank you to the 1999 legislators and the members that who were involved in the support of that legislation. I agree with many of the pieces of the testimony that has been given to you today. This bill is, from my perspective at any rate, an issue having much to do with the demographics of Oregon itself. I don't need to preach about that there is urban Oregon, a suburban Oregon, and then a very large segment that is rural Oregon. And the state's assumption of a dominant role in school finance for its public school system. In our judgment, in the small community of Fall City, is in a state of transition. I think the existing funding formula has done much to equalize the kind of education that's available to students, regardless of whether it's urban or suburban or rural. I think we're at a fine-tuning stage, and that's why the board of directors of my school district and myself and the community that I represent are here in support of this legislation today. The legislation does provide, in a sense, an interim financial step to add a little additional support to our high school. I have currently six teachers, and because I'm in a slightly declining enrollment situation in Fall City, I am having to reduce that to five. With this legislation in place, I will be able to bring it up to 5.5. 5.5 is not enough to offer the same kind of educational opportunity for the students in Fall City as elsewhere in the state. And so additional funds are needed, because as you shrink the size of an organization and the services that teachers provide, there is a kind of a floor that we have in many discussions in private determined to be an appropriate level to be able to provide equal educational opportunity for our students. I'm as equally supportive of the piece of this legislation that stipulates that there be a study done during the interim process, and I would encourage the legislature to put strong demands on the Department of Education to work with the small school community throughout the state, regardless of geography, to really look carefully at how we fund the smaller schools in the state, in the rural parts of the state, regardless of whether it's the east side, the west side, the south. With that, again, I'd just like to repeat my support of this legislation. I believe it's a step in the right direction, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? All right, I appreciate your coming in today to testify on behalf of this bill. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 519 before I close the hearing today? All right, then in that case, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 519. Thank everyone again for coming all the way to talk to us today. And we'll move right along with the agenda to open the public hearing on House Bill 3972. Who's that? Who?
Yeah.
Ed.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Have you scheduled a work session for this bill yet?
I don't think we have yet.
Do you plan to?
Oh, yeah.
Testify from down there.
Yeah. Do you want to go down? Sure.
Mark Lister,
yeah. Where? Yeah. Oh,
did he come
in? Okay. Co-pilot. Representative Merkley, do you want to come on up to the witness table there while we're getting the background from Ed on House Bill 3972?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3972 allows an additional 3-year carry forward for unused pollution control facility tax credits, providing the qualifying facility remains in operation during that period. This would apply to tax credits that are unexpired in tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2002. Also, it should be noted that under current law, the pollution control facilities tax credit expires at the end of the current year.
Is that it?
That's it.
Revenue impact?
You have a statement in front of you. The changes in this bill would not have a significant revenue impact in the current biennium, or in the 2001-2003 biennium, as near as I can tell. It would apply to credits for facilities that have already been certified, and would only have a revenue impact if there are certifications where the credit is expiring during this current period, this 1 or 2 year window, that would otherwise not be able to be carried forward. And I can't personally identify any facilities like that. There may be some.
That's for the the next biennium. And what about the tail effect of something of a change like this?
Again, it's minimal, but I think minimal.
Okay, Representative Merkley, Representative Brown.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Alan Brown from House District 4. And given the lecture that Representative Beck delivered to the other witnesses, I'm not sure whether I should ask for something for rural Oregon here or not. Governor Tom McCall initiated the Pollution Tax Credit Program for Oregon industry, and this program is due to sunset this year. House Bill 3972 will allow companies with unused pollution tax credits 3 additional years to utilize those credits. This bill does not extend the program in that companies can continue to earn income credits. This bill only permits using existing credits over the, for those extending 3 years. The Georgia-Pacific Corporation made extensive modifications to their paper plant in Toledo in my district. These changes permitted them to better utilize recyclable waste to produce paper products and to deal with pollution concerns. The mill uses up to 60% recycled material, which are our old cardboard boxes. GP accumulated considerable tax credits with these modifications that they had made to their plant. This plant employs 529 people at a very good family wage. Their total payroll is $38 million in a county where the unemployment rate is now over 7% and is often in double digits during the winter months. The state average is 5.8%. GP pays $2.8 million in property taxes, and this plant made $71,000 in charitable contributions last year to Lincoln County schools, scholarships, and other programs in Lincoln County. At the end of World War II, there was 56 sawmills in Lincoln County. Today, there are none. When I moved to Newport nearly 30 years ago, there were 7 fish processing plants on the bayfront. Today, there are 2 with 1 ownership. Many jobs were lost when these mills and fish plants closed. Nothing has been successful in replacing these jobs. The poverty level in Lincoln County is 23%. As compared to the state average of 16.3%. The labor force has declined in Lincoln County over recent years due to people moving out of the county and retiring or giving up on searching for jobs that paid family wages. The GP plant is the last large private employer in Lincoln County. This plant's financial health is of paramount importance to the success of the people of Lincoln County. Utilizing these earned pollution tax credits is a key component to the Toledo's plant's financial health. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I want to comment briefly about the way a tax credit works. In general, it's handed out in 10 annual increments comprising 1/10 of the amount of the total tax credit. Under the current law, the pollution tax credits can be used in the first year, and if not used, can be carried over for each of 3 subsequent years. And that applies to each increment separately. So to put it simply, the first increment can be used between years 1 and 4, the second increment between years 2 and 5, third between 3 and 6, and so on and so forth. So what this bill does is it says, we have made a deal with a company. And the deal is that if they stay in the state, continue producing product, continue to contribute to the economy of the state, continue to employ workers, and renovate a plant in this predetermined way to make all of that happen, we will help them pay part of the cost of it through these tax credits. Well, that's fairly straightforward, but then what can happen, and what's happened at least one significant case, is after making this enormous investment, you go into a business slump. And essentially, the company is not able to utilize the tax credits because they have no profit against which to use the tax credits. So now you have a perverse situation. You have the company that is profitable, is able to utilize the subsidy that came out of the deal with the state, and the company that is staying alive and staying employed and is trying to work through the slump is unable to utilize the share of the deal that the state threw into the renovation of the plant. Well, this bill provides a little bit more flexibility to try to avoid this type of unfortunate situation. And it increases the carryover period from 3 years to 6 years. So now you can use the first increment in years 1 through 7, the second increment in years 2 through 8, and each increment has 3 more years tacked onto it. So the total period in which the tax credits can be used from the very beginning to the very end, instead of being 10 plus 3 or 13 years, is now 10 plus 6 or 16 years. Hopefully, within a 6-year period, the economy will go up and down, and it will be possible for the company to utilize the tax credits. I think this fulfills the intent of the deal that was struck with the company when they undertook to do a massive renovation to protect the environment and to keep people employed. I think it's a very modest change. You will notice in the key language on page 2 of the bill, line 30 through 37, that they've put in a clause which says that it can be carried only if the facility is in use and operation during the tax year following the third succeeding year, and so on and so forth, following the fourth succeeding year, fifth succeeding year. So this does not allow a company to shut down the plant and then still take advantage of the tax break. So in exchange, and that was an additional requirement from the original structure. The original structure of the bill didn't address that. So in exchange for getting 3 more years, they're also saying we will keep the plant open and operating. So I think this is a fair deal all the way around, and I encourage the committee to support it.
Questions for either Representative Brown or Representative Merkley? Representative Bates?
This is probably more to Alfo. If there's no foreseeable revenue impact, then what is the benefit of the company? I mean, doesn't seem a little logical. I mean, I'm missing something here.
Ed, do you want to answer that? Okay.
Well, it gives them the opportunity to utilize the tax credits that they've already accumulated. And there's people here from Georgia-Pacific that will testify to the amount of those credits. I'll leave that to them.
Have they already been paid for tax credits? I mean, they've got tax credits sitting on there. They haven't been able to offload yet, and they haven't been paid for yet.
Representative Bates, members of the committee, what it does is it allows banking, basically, of unused credits for a longer period of time. I think ultimately this will allow companies that otherwise would lose some of their credits to be able to utilize it.
Right.
But I think that the main effect of that is going to be further into the future. So while the revenue impact in the next biennium may be minimal at points along the way, there will be times when it will allow more credit to be used than could be under current law.
So what kind of tax credits, as an example, does Georgia-Pacific have right now?
Mr. Chair, maybe I can, and Representative Bates, maybe I can expand on the answer a little. If you can imagine a company that has a slump in years 1 through 4, and they weren't able to utilize their first year's tax credits, there's no fiscal impact during that period. Then comes along the fifth year, and under this bill, they would utilize their first year's tax credits instead of utilizing their fifth year's tax credits. So essentially, the place you will see the revenue impact will not be in the first 10 years because they're receiving tax credits all of those years, but they will be using a different set of tax credits, hoping that their company improves well enough that before the 16 years up are up, they can utilize all of them. So it's probably in the years 14, 15, 16 that you will see an impact of having been able to change the way they manage their tax credits.
And that gets to be, that's the tail that I was talking about.
Right. And that's I understood all that. Okay, before I asked the question, remains, maybe I should ask it differently, what's the tail cost?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, the company will be able to speak more to the exact amount of the tax credits. The initial answer is that it all depends on what the economy does in those years, because if the company has no profit during years 14, 15, and 16, it will not cost the state anything, because the state won't be able to utilize the tax credits.
I think we're looking at probably the, I don't want to say worst case scenario, but the maximum the maximum yes. size.
They don't know what their profits are going to be.
The maximum impact,
they,
I guess.
They don't know what their taxes are going to be, so they don't know what taxes are, they can't figure out, but they should be able to.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, it is possible to calculate the maximum amount that could conceivably be experienced. That would occur in a case where you essentially have a slump that means none of the tax credits for the years 8, 9, and 10 are utilized until years 14, 15, or 16. So by totaling the amount of tax credits issued for 8, 9, and 10, you have the maximum potential exposure to the state.
It's a good bill. I support it. I vote for it. I'd like to have a little more information. I'm not trying to beat you guys up, okay?
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Folks, that's all we had signed up to testify. Is there anybody? There are a lot of suits in this room. Anybody else want to speak?
Just watch.
I didn't know for sure if I was going to testify. Former State Representative Terry Thompson. I worked on this issue during the 6 years I was in the legislature. And it's been a success because it's worked. Now, I'm going to just speak on real-world terms of what's going on. What we've done is taken a mill that was handling wood chips and turned it into a cardboard recycling facility, which is good for the state of Oregon. A lot of the cardboard recycling products come from everywhere west of the Mississippi, flows into that mill. It's improved recycling in the state. It's made a value out of a product that was somewhat of a minimal product. Anything we can do to improve recycling in the state helps all citizens of the state of Oregon. I think there's a benefit to this type of tax credit. I think it's a benefit to the mill and to the state of Oregon to make sure that this moves forward. Let me tell you a little about what's really gone on in the real world. I fish out of that port of Toledo occasionally and bring my boats up there. And for years, there was some small amount of residue occasionally on the boat. Today, because of this pollution control tax credit and because of the change in the mill, that boat can go up there and the air and the environment is greatly enhanced in that area. This mill has been a good citizen to the community, and I'm glad to support this kind of legislation. I think it's good economic development for the rural part of the state, and we need that bad in the state right now.
Questions for Mr. Thompson? Anybody? All right, thanks, Mr. Okay, if there's nobody else coming to the table, and okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for allowing this hearing. I'm Peggy Sotto, Regional Manager for Governmental Affairs for Georgia Pacific. And with me today is Mike Edwards on my left from Corporate Tax Department in Atlanta, and on my right, Sam Stevens, Regional Tax Manager, the wide smart people in the company. The bill is basically important to us for the large investment we made in updating the plant in Toledo, Oregon. It was GP's first paper mill in the country, the only mill for Georgia Pacific, the only mill that Georgia Pacific has built from scratch, which was our entry into the pulp and paper business. Simply put, we're afraid that we won't be able to fully utilize the large credits we earned on investments at that mill, and this bill gives us some flexibility to do that. So if you have any questions, we're here to answer them.
Did you want to testify, or are you just here to answer questions?
They're my backup, just okay. Insurance policy.
You're Mike Edwards and Sam.
Mike Edwards, sir.
Any questions? Like no? Thank you.
Thank you.
So what is the desire of the Vice Chair? The co-vice going to close the public hearing and adjourn the committee. I think that sounds like a great idea. Okay, if there's no other questions, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3972. And if there's no other business, we will adjourn the committee.